What's up, everybody? You're listening to No Coast Cinema here on WGN Plus. We are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago and all around the world. I'm Tom Hush.
And I'm Connor Cornelius.
And we're so glad to be back with you for another week of No Coast Cinema. A little bit later on in our feature presentation segment, we talk to Raul Benitez and Nando Espinoza, two film programmers for Comfort Film at Comfort Station, which is located in Logan Square. It's a fantastic screening series that goes for about 8 to 10 months out of the year, where every week they show a movie for free over at Comfort Station. They've been recently featured on the New City's Film 50, a list of the most influential people in film in the city of Chicago. So we talked to them a little bit about what Comfort Film is all about, the history of Comfort Station, and all that good stuff, how they choose the films. And then a little bit later on in our after credits, we talk a little bit about Blade Runner 2049 and the Rotten Tomatoes effect, something that we've touched on before, but we want to revisit again. But for right now, we want to get into probably the biggest news story of the year so far for film. Harvey Weinstein, co-founder of the Weinstein Company, former executive at Miramax, one of the biggest figures in film, has now been suspended from the Weinstein Company indefinitely following some pretty serious allegations of sexual harassment within the company dating about 30 years or so time span.
And this comes from a New York Times article, which was released on Thursday.
Correct.
And this whole response to this thing has sort of just exploded in the last week.
Yes. A lot of tweets, a lot of reactions by members of the film community who have seen this article and are kind of chiming in a little bit on their own personal experiences with Mr. Weinstein. It's been a huge, huge thing being covered all over the place. Connor, can you give us a little bit of a timeline of how this story has started to break into the actual mainstream?
Right. So on Monday or Tuesday, the New York Times hinted that they had sort of a bombshell article brewing concerning Harvey Weinstein, and Harvey Weinstein immediately lawyered up, and then he also issued a public statement that said that the story sounded so good that he wanted to buy the movie rights to it and begin production immediately, which is really just a callous response to the, especially in light of the allegations that are presented in the New York Times article.
Yeah, because really, is that really the best way to respond to allegations of sexual harassment, with arrogance and the sort of flippant attitude,
just touting his influence?
Christ.
It's it's pretty much insanity. It's burgeoning on sociopathic.
Yes.
So a little bit of a timeline for this. The allegations have gone back about 3 decades, but perhaps the most jarring one, the most emblematic one, because there is definitely a common thread with all of the stories that these women have come forward with. So about 2 decades ago, Harvey Weinstein invited Ashley Judd, an actress who was filming Kiss the Girls at the time, to his hotel for a meeting. And obviously, she was busy, but she thought it was too important an opportunity to pass up. And then when she got there, an attendant at the hotel told her that he wanted to meet her in his private room. And when he finally met her, he was in his bathrobe, began to ask her if she would give him a massage. And when she said no, he, in his mind, apparently downgraded it to asking for a shoulder rub. And then she said no. And then he said, would you like to watch me shower? And she kept saying no, and he kept persisting with his advances. And this is really emblematic, like I said, of the sort of stories that the women have been telling over the last 30 years.
It's that common thread of he invites them to a private meeting, which is supposedly about business. They wind up in a situation where he is asking for massages, back rubs, having them watch him shower. And that's the common thread with all of this.
Under the guise and in some cases a verbal promise that he will further their careers if they do the things that he is asking him to do. And if you think that this is just something that happened decades ago, that is not the case. In 2014, he invited Emily Nestor to the same hotel that he invited Ashley Judd, said he would boost her career if she accepted his sexual advances. In 2015, he had another woman give him a massage while he was naked under the pretense that he could further her career. And per this New York Times article, Harvey Weinstein has been reaching settlements with women to keep them from disclosing his improprieties for at least 3 decades.
There are many women, as reported in that article, that are under non-disclosure agreements. as a result of these settlements, which is harrowing, really, because that means that not only is he is giving them hush money. He is saying, take this money, but you don't get to say a goddamn word. And if that isn't a symbol of male power in Hollywood, I really don't know what is.
And there are plenty of similar stories in the news, especially over the last several months. You know, you've got the Fox newscasters that are doling out millions of dollars in settlement for their indiscretions. But Weinstein reportedly has given out less than $100,000 for the silence of these women that he has harassed and abused, which is pretty much unconscionable. Obviously, the actions themselves are unconscionable, but the fact that he seems to be getting away with kind of pennies on the dollar to his peers that are committing the same sort of atrocities, it's unconscionable.
It's unbelievable. Let's look at the legal team that he's assembled here. He had hired Lisa Bloom, who is a crisis counselor, and she's worked with people like Kathy Griffin most recently with the situation with her and Donald Trump, the severed head mm-hmm. incident. She has been apparently working with him for about a year on, you know, how to change his ways and attitudes around women, which is kind of screwed up that if you have to literally hire someone to teach you how to work with women, like, how is that a thing? And like, you need that kind of
exactly.
coaching.
And yeah, she said that part of their coaching session, she had to tell Harvey Weinstein that his influence in the industry and the fact that he is such a powerful figure is intimidating to people. And it seemed as though he didn't understand that already, as if he wasn't using that to sort of to facilitate his predatory, you know,
actions, his behaviors.
Yeah, exactly.
And so Lisa Bloom is still with him at this point, helping him with the crisis management of these allegations. He also hired Charles Harder, who is the lawyer who repped Hulk Hogan in the case against Gawker.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
which destroyed the company.
Absolutely. Yeah. Gawker Media is gone. Now, this case in particular with Hulk Hogan has been looked at in retrospect as a very dangerous moment in entertainment journalism, because it kind of said to everybody that the journalists don't get to decide what is of public note. It's that one was difficult for me for Hulk Hogan, but I really didn't want to see Gawker go away because they were willing to take risks and burn some bridges in order to report on certain things. And I don't like that this case is basically now being used as precedent to say the New York Times cannot report on allegations against Harvey Weinstein simply because it reduces his stature in the public eye. He is suing the New York Times, correct?
To the tune of $50 million for reckless reporting.
And which is really sad. The author of the article, or one of the authors of the article, Jody Cantor, is a well-known investigative journalist. She has been spending a lot of time working on this article. The AV Club, specifically Katie Reif, fantastic writer at the AV Club, reported that that Cantor had been digging through some of the human resources records of the Weinstein Company to find these incidents. This is well-reported journalism. The New York Times is not to be taken lightly. These journalists are doing their job. They found a story, and it's their job to report on it, whether or not it, you know, potentially downgrades or flat out ends the career of a major Hollywood figure. And it is also worth noting that it's not just a Times article that he was lawyering up for, Mr. Weinstein. He was also lawyering up for a supposedly forthcoming New Yorker article written by Ronan Farrow, who is the son of Mia Farrow and Woody Allen, former MSNBC host. And, knowing the family history between Mia Farrow, Woody Allen, Ronan Farrow, his dad is married to his stepsister.
Oh, okay.
Like, he definitely knows where this goes,
yeah.
You know, in terms of Hollywood influence. And so we have not seen anything from The New Yorker, from Ronan Farrow. That's just kind of what was reported on when people found out that this Times article was going to happen. It is also worth noting that there's been plenty more developments, including Weinstein being suspended from the company by the board of the Weinstein Company. A third of the board of the Weinstein Company has now resigned.
Yes.
A third of them. So I guess a big question is,
it's hard to say that these allegations are baseless.
Yeah, it's absolutely, like, we're talking about well-known actresses such as Ashley Judd, such as Rose McGowan.
Mm-hmm.
It's horrifying, and they've been reacting on Twitter as well. I believe it was Amber Tamblyn that sent out a tweet that said, remember, like she said, I have this mantra, women have nothing to gain from coming forward, but everything to lose. And I think that's really important to keep in our heads, is that these women are not coming out. They have nothing to gain from telling people that Weinstein sexually harassed them, sexually assaulted them, whatever the allegations are. This needs to happen. You can't have someone in power in Hollywood continuing to do this over and over and over again, especially in light of what was happening with Harry Knowles and Devin Faraci over with the Alamo Drafthouse and Fantastic Fest. It's also recently come out that there are allegations against the creator of the very popular Honest Trailers series on YouTube, an Emmy-winning short. And that fella has been suspended as of now. So,
and Harvey has been doing this for decades across the entire world.
Mm-hmm.
And the people, there's the common narrative, you know, he's been targeting women typically in their mid-20s. They're aspiring actresses. And it's important that we talk about this, because it's important that people understand that especially young people trying to make it in the industry, they need to know that this is not okay, that this is not the way that the industry is run, that this is not the way that the industry should be run, and we need to be able to hold the executives and the industry on the whole to a higher standard than that.
Yeah. It's almost like something, it's one of those things. I think it's funny that he said, the story sounds so good, I want to buy the movie rights. Well, I mean, this is almost like, it sounds like a movie. Like, there's a, you know, there is this common, somewhat darkly comic narrative that, like, in order to get ahead in Hollywood, you have to sleep with people. And it's, I think it's not funny. It's like, this is really happening to people. For every woman that said no at the Weinstein Company, think of all the women who felt so pressured that they went through with it and they had to get paid, you know, they got paid hush money, or they had their, I don't want to speculate too much, but, like, we don't know exactly how many women have been sexually harassed by Harvey Weinstein.
Right. And this article came out on Thursday, and since then, 8 more people have come forward. A ninth, actually, recently, who was a TV reporter that said that he literally masturbated in front of her at one of those private hotel meetings.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
And it's despicable.
Yeah. And we need to keep an eye on this in film communities everywhere. You know, I like to believe that the film community can be a safe place for people to be expressive and to enjoy something that's very personal to them. And I know you and I are massive film fans. It's part of our identity.
Absolutely.
Is being a fan of cinema. And that needs to go for everybody. That needs to go for women. That needs to go for people of color. There needs to be some sort of accountability here. And I mean, we don't mean to harp too much on something we talked about last week. We already talked about the situation with Harry Knowles and Devin Faraci.
But obviously, this is happening at every scale of the industry. And
yeah,
as to borrow a point from last week, it's important that we talk about it, because that's how change happens.
Yeah. We need to make this real. We need to make this tangible for people to know that these things are happening and something needs to be done about it. So I'm happy that Harvey Weinstein has been suspended from his company. I think the third of the board resigning was probably a smart thing to do. Like,
yeah,
you can't be near this.
No.
I don't know what the future of the Weinstein Company is, because let's be honest, for all the shitty things that Harvey Weinstein has done, he's also had a hand in some of the biggest movies of the last, like, 20 or so years.
Yeah. Extremely talented film executive. He's got like Pulp Fiction in his belt. You know, he's,
Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
Yep.
Steven Soderbergh's debut.
He's no stranger to taking small indie films and blowing them up into, you know, big Hollywood spectacles like The King's Speech.
Yeah, he has Oscars under his belt. So maybe it just speaks to how high profile this goes. We're talking about single-handedly one of the most influential people in Hollywood using people underneath him, using his position of power to get what he wants. And we can't take it anymore. I'm done with it. I don't want to hear any more of this. I hope he stays out of the industry, because he's had and something to mention is that in the article, he gave a statement saying that he's basically admitted to doing bad things.
Yeah, and he knows that he's affected people's lives in wholly negative ways.
Which is funny that he's now suing the Times for, you know, reckless reporting, basically, because he's like, oh, I did lots of bad things, but not these specifically.
But I've got money, so f*** you.
Yeah. God damn it! Oh. We here at NoCo Cinema take a staunch stand against any sort of sexual harassment, sexual assault, or any sort of sex crimes, any sort of discrimination. And I just want our listeners to know that. I want them to know that we're going to continue to follow stories like this. We're not going to let this go. So be prepared to hear more in the future from hopefully people who are more expert than us about this. We're merely reacting at this point. We're trying to give you an overview of what's happening. If you don't already know, then you know the seriousness of these allegations. So, let's believe survivors. Let's believe these accusations and take them seriously as possible. Right. So let's move on to lighter things.
Deep breath, yeah.
Into our feature presentation segment coming up next. We're talking to Raul Benitez and Nando Espinoza about Comfort Film, a place where people can be positive and enjoy film for free and be part of a really great community. That's coming up next here on No Coast Cinema. Listening to NoCo Cinema here on WGN Plus. We are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago and all around the world. I am Tom Hush.
And I'm Connor Cornelius.
And we're so excited to have two fantastic guests here for our feature presentation segment. It's Raul Benitez and Nando Espinoza. They're here from Comfort Film, which is a screening series that takes place at Comfort Station in Logan Square, where they're screening fantastic films for everybody for free. Welcome so much to the program, Raul and Nando.
Thank you for having us. After a long time of trying to meet up, we finally made it.
Yeah, there was you reached out to us a long time ago, and we were like, oh, this is the greatest idea. I love this. Let's get him in. And what is it? Like 4 months later,
yeah,
we're finally in studio.
It was a while.
It had to be a thing of the fall. It couldn't be a thing of the summer.
Yeah, there we go. Well, now that it's fall, we have got you in the studio. Let's start out with, in your own words, can you tell us what Comfort Film is? How did it start, and what is the goal of Comfort Film?
Well, first, I'll start with the space that we're in. So we're at Comfort Station, which is kind of like a historic landmark in the middle of Logan Square. I don't know if any of you have seen it, but it's like that little house on an island, and like all the traffic goes around it.
It's right next to the obelisk.
Yeah, by the monument of the eagle. And that place was built in the 20s as a shelter for commuters, mostly for like commuters that used to go on the trolley bus on Milwaukee, or they would wait for the L used to end at the Logan Auditorium when it was elevated before they moved it underground in the 60s. So it was used for a shelter, basically for a comfort station. And then after the whole like dismantling of that, the trolley system, they pretty much closed the building down, and it was unused for like 40 years or so. It was just used as storage for like lawn equipment.
And there are several buildings actually that ran down up and down Milwaukee Avenue, but that's the only one. There's only two remaining because all the other ones were basically torn down by the city. which the Logan Square Preservation, who leases the building from the city, pretty much had the idea of like, well, this is a historic building. You know, there's no longer any of those around in the city, except for another one in Oak Park that is all boarded up. So this one is the one that remains in what used to be a series of them just spread across the city, not just Milwaukee and Logan Square.
Well, I've got to say, this is a little surreal for me because I used to live right there. I used to live at the corner of Wrightwood and Spalding, and I would always walk by that little house, and sometimes I would even see that there were movies being projected onto a screen in there, and there was, you know, an audience and everything. And I always wanted to know, like, how is that? How do you get an invitation to that? How do you get involved in that? So for our listeners, how can people come and see the movies that you guys are screening? Because you guys have a lot going on this month.
Yeah, it's funny because I run into this all the time. I was at a party last night for a film opening for a festival that we're hosting, and I had several people tell me, like, I never knew the place was open, and I've been living here forever. And it's like, the space is not, like, it's open to the public. Like, all the events are open. Our screenings are open to the public. They're free. And they're, you know, we have three core programs at Cover Station, the art, the music, and the film. And the art is throughout the month, and then the film, which is us, is on Wednesday nights, every Wednesday night all the way to December. So we start like April all the way to December.
Wow.
And then we have music on Thursdays. So it's open and free for everybody. Anybody can come in. You know, it's a great spot because people walk by and they look through the window and they see stuff going on and they just come in randomly. And they sit down. Like that happened last night or Wednesday night when we had a film where there were some people that looked through the window and saw something was happening. They came inside and they sat down and watched the movie. Yeah. So, our space is very fluid like that. Like, people come in and, you know, just out of the blue. And we get like you. You're like, I've been living here forever, and I've never been here.
I mean, but yeah, for audiences, to answer your question, how they can get, you know, more information on that, we, as Comfort Station, have a profile on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram, and also us, too, as Comfort Film, have our own profile. So, you know, people can just, you know, a quick Google search, Facebook search, you can find Comfort Film or Comfort Station, Logan Square, and people can subscribe to the events. We have a really cool thing going on throughout the month, which is going to be horror films. But, you know, we'll get into that. But, yeah, I'm sure we'll go back at the end, too. But, yeah, Comfort Station, Logan Square, and Comfort Film have their own profiles. People can just find that, subscribe to the events. And we also have a newsletter, so you can get a newsletter for Comfort Film every month that highlights what we're going to have throughout that month. And Comfort Station sends one out every week, which, you know, highlights other things that we have going on. But really, the films are, you know, the coolest thing we have in there.
Yeah. Well, very I mean, my thing is film. If I'm going to be going to Comfort Station, it would primarily be for the film, but it's great to know that they have a lot of arts programming. So both of you are the film programmers for Comfort Film. I want to ask, what is the process you guys go through when choosing the films you're going to show? I know that for October, you've got the horror selection going on, but throughout your entire filming screening season, how do you decide between the two of you, this is the movie we're going to show?
We usually we're starting to plan now for next year already.
Wow.
And part of the reason is we have limited dates, obviously. We only can do Wednesdays. And then once in a while we have, like, dates other than Wednesday. But we get a lot of we have a proposal form, so people fill that out. We get proposals through that way. A lot of it is just, like, chit-chatting with other, you know, going to other events and talking to filmmakers.
Film programmers.
And other film programmers. And
film artists.
You know, we get a lot of films through that way, just you know, from smooching with other people. And then we do partnerships. So, for example, the films that we're showing this month for Halloween, it's a partnership with Paul Furtak, who's a reviewer at dailygrindhouse.com. Mm-hmm. And they're also a sponsor of the films. And that's an extension of a series we have so every last Wednesday of the month, we show films that were released on VHS but not on DVD or shown theatrically. And Paul Furtak, he curates those for us, and he gets the projection rights. And that separates us a little bit from other series around the city where we actually try to do the right thing and get projection rights for most of the films we show, either from the filmmakers themselves or from distributors. And we've been very lucky that because we're an art space and we're free and we're public, we usually get free projection rights.
Really? So, like, because you are doing almost like a, it's almost like a community sort of serve or a community building sort of
thing.
It
is, and we host community. Other community organizations use our space to do stuff, right. Meetings or whatever. So, yeah, we're a community space as well as an art space. So, we in our programming part, we get stuff with partnerships. A lot of it, like I said, is smooching. We get some film proposals. People email us randomly, or they meet us at another screening. We get a lot of movies through that way, where filmmakers or somebody comes up to us and says, hey, we love what you're doing. We want to be part of it. We have a film. So if we could fit them in and if it feels right, we do. And we, over the years, we've been very lucky in finding stuff. So we haven't had too much of a problem in the past 2 years of filling up the dates because we got a lot of people coming in.
And our programming is very eclectic and diverse. One of the things that I guess we always discuss, Rome and myself, is that we try not to be elitist in the kind of work that we show. Because there's an idea that, somehow the stuff that is shown in an art gallery has to be, like, very highbrow, kind of like art, abstract, experimental. We have shown abstract. We have shown surreal. We have shown experimental film. But, something like, hey, we're going to show a movie from the 1980s that's in VHS, that it was really bad, that it never actually, made it past the home video market, that we also enjoy the diversity on that programming. So we try not to be... kind of like restricted onto what we show. Not to say that we just show whatever. We usually want people to know that they can know the space as opposed to just like programming without first meeting the programmer or the curator. That's what makes our programming so cool, and that's why people are not afraid to like approach as opposed to like other places that have like a very, I don't want to say high standards because I think we have high standards, but they're very selective on their work that they show or who they show.
Yeah, and I think that's important to be a space that's open and not, because let's face it, like people are kind of afraid of going to, they see an art gallery and they already think like artsy, mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
They're, it's
like,
going to be all David Lynch.
Yeah, and it's going to be like worse. They're kind of scared of that art and we try to be broad-based in our programming because we're an open space and we're free and... That reflects in our audience. Like, our audience is different all the time. We don't, we don't have, like, a steady people that come all the time to everything. We have a different audience all the time. Yep. And that's a reflection of how we're programming and doing partnerships. And that's important.
Absolutely. It seems like it's a very community-driven event. And I did want to ask, so you guys are the programmers. Obviously, you do bring in some other people with partnerships for curation. I did want to ask about the types of films that you're showing every month. It sounds like you guys are active, 8 months out of the year, and you guys are screening at least once a week.
Yeah, sometimes up to 10 months because we start sometimes as early as March and go all the way to, like, December. Yeah, because we started, I think, this year, like, late March.
Yeah, we have people already, like, saying, hey, can we show something in March? Because we take a break during the winter.
Yeah.
Conversation does. We all take a break from January till March, and then we restart in April. But the past couple of years, we've sat something, like, at the end of March. What was your question again?
Yeah, I didn't actually ask it, but thank you, Nando, for clearing that up. I did want to ask, do you guys tie it to like a thematic, do you tie your curation to like a thematic thing or do you just every month?
No, or? not really. The only thing we have like the VHS things are regular series. Mm-hmm. But most of the dates are kind of like, it's, the program is different. Like for example, the 13th, we're hosting the Chicago Ethnographic Film Festival. So we're a venue for them this year. We're also a venue for the Twisted Oyster Film Festival. It's totally totally different things.
And that'll be at Comfort Station?
That's at Comfort Station, okay. Yes. And
Ethnographic Voices, Ethnographic Collected Voices is the 13th, which is coming up this
October
Friday.
13th.
Yeah.
So it's obviously different than what our horror films are, obviously. Mm-hmm. Then, like, last month, the first 2 weeks of last month, we were celebrating El Santo's 100th anniversary birthday. So we showed two El Santo films the first mm-hmm. 2 Wednesdays of the month. In that way, it's kind of thematic.
Yeah,
but normally, it's not. Yeah. Normally, it's kind of, like, all over the place. Like, we might have an experimental series one Wednesday. We might have something else another Wednesday.
The only thing that we have done that is sort of thematic where where it's more than just film program, but also kind of like booking bands. We do this thing on the summer that is very popular. We show silent films with live music. So we show films from the silent era, you know, 19-teens, 1920s. And we pair local bands or bands based in the city.
Really?
And they create, yeah, and they create a score just for that one night. Sometimes it's worked out that, you know, they not only put so much effort, but people want to see more of it, that they do it more than once. And, you know, we have been there for 5 years. And in that time, we have brought over 20 bands to play silent music for a silent film. And that's something that no other places does. We do that for a whole month, by the way. So it's like 4 Wednesdays. You come in, and every Wednesday we're going to show a silent film, and there's going to be a band playing live music, and it's going to be free, and it's going to be outdoors. That's the thing that we have thematic, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
I wanted to ask about this idea of showing the films outside and free and having this big community engagement. I feel like this really eschews the current problem in filmmaking, which is price. Price is putting a lot of people out of going out to see the movies. You know, people can just stay home and watch Netflix for $9.99 a month, as opposed to spending, you know, like $30 just on maybe a ticket and a movie, sometimes more. And this idea of the community bringing people together to enjoy film in a much more, I don't know, interesting way, like... Do you feel that comfort film is a pushback against this sterilized idea of film of viewing a film?
No, I don't think so. I think the outdoor thing with the silent films, we feel that it's definitely a community event where like everybody from the neighborhood comes, you know, and they like lay out on the lawn, and I think putting the music aspect to it, live music aspect to it, really makes it more compelling for people to come out and see it. Mm-hmm. Because it's like a one-time event and you're not going to see it anywhere else. And a lot of these bands, a lot of these people never heard of, because we try to be like as eclectic with the choosing of the bands as possible. Because mm-hmm. I mean, we've had from like a chamber orchestra to a punk band 1 year do a score.
I did want to ask how you guys choose the bands for that, because that sounds like a Herculean task.
Gotten better over the years because... The first time we did it, we kind of we started searching for bands. Mm-hmm. But now that the word's gone out a little bit, we've had people come to us now and say, "I want to do this." And a lot of bands do want to do this because it's a unique opportunity to score a film, and it's not an opportunity that a band gets all the time, especially a band like a punk band, right? Like which was Terror.
Terror, shout out because they're my boys. which, by the way, was the longest set they had to play. It's a punk band; they usually play like 30 minutes, and they're, you know.
Yeah, they picked up 45-minute movie,
like 60 minutes
or 60 minutes. Minutes which, and they did a great job, because I was like, man, how are they going to do this?
Did they change their style at all? Or
no, they actually had a great theme. They had like an underlying theme to all the score of the music that they did.
They pick a silent action film, which was also directed by a woman, which I think was the first time we were showing a silent film directed by a woman. And because the film had a bunch of like car chases, and it was this really wild movie out in the desert, where like this whole thing revolves around how I think the girl gets on the car to save her fiance or something like that. So they picked a movie that kind of had that punk attitude, and they just adapted. Some of their songs actually were adapted to play a little bit longer. But they also created the bassist who I was talking to. He was like, "No, we're creating some heroic music for this."
Yeah, it was a movie called Something New.
Yeah,
something new.
Which talked about the cars at the point when, you know, cars were being mass produced.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's great. It's a great movie, and they did a great score. And the great thing about the silent film series that we do is you don't know what you're going to get. Like we don't know what the score is going to be like until that night.
Yeah.
And we've been very lucky. We've gotten some amazing artists. This past summer, we had 2 extra silent film screenings. One of them was at the Hyde Park Art Center. And we had Ben Lamar Gray, who's like a great, I don't know if you ever heard of him. He's like a really great trumpetist and horn player. And that score was the one they did was with...
Within Our Gates?
The movie was Within Our Gates, which is an African-American silent film. And the score they did was amazing. And he was doing the sound effects with his horn. Like, So it
so
was
like he's playing the score, and then also when something happens, he's doing
the sound effect of whatever's happening. It was amazing.
That's a tall order,
and we're very lucky because a lot of these. I mean, what we do is, you know, we're donation based, so we give whatever donations we get that night, we give it all to the artists. Wow. To the musicians, because they put a lot of work. Some of them take it really serious and work on it for months. Mm-hmm.
We also had this beautiful score done for called Theodore Dreyer's The Passion of Joan of Arc, which was made by this really cool artist called Alexa Gray and Maya Luz. They created this beautiful electronic operatic score for this very dense film about like the trail of Joan of Arc. And another thing that should be highlighted is that we don't assign the films to the bands. We actually give the bands a list that has the films that we suggest, you know, could be a film that they could make. And then they find the film that best adapts to their music. That's why, you know, something like Terra picks an action film, something like Alexa Gray, who they're classically trained in opera, choose a more operatic, dramatic film. And that's something really cool because for a lot of these bands and musicians, it's the first time they're actually interacting with like visual images, which is something which again, you know, kind of transcends just like, oh, we're just going to show a movie. Mm-hmm. For them, it does this really cool thing, which brings collaborations. Like we collaborate with the bands or with other programmers. They get to like bring people they never worked with before so that they can create just for that one night that specific score, which is really a cool thing to have all together.
Yeah. That series is really popular for us. And it was especially popular for us this year. We were getting audiences over 100 people on our little tiny lawn. So we've been very lucky with that series. And we show other films on the lawn. Earlier this year, we showed the WNUF Halloween special, which I don't know if you guys ever seen that.
No.
Where they it's like a found footage film where somebody found a videotape and it was somebody recorded a TV special during Halloween in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And it comes with like the commercials of the era and the weird newscasts of during Halloween. And they do a special broadcast where they go into this house where somebody got murdered and they bring like paranormal
investigators
who have a cat. that could you know feel paranormal presences, so we do stuff like that outdoors too, and we also show like classic films. We showed His Girl Friday one year, which is on the public domain.
Yeah, yeah. That must make it a lot easier if you can get those films that are in the public domain.
Yeah, and we don't do that as much as we used to because we get more original stuff now. But if we have a gap in the programming, we throw something in like that.
With the I want to say if our listeners have not read the New City Film 50 yet, you guys were both chosen for the New City Film 50, and this is the second time, I believe, correct?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, congratulations. That's awesome.
Thank you.
And what is the New City Film 50?
The New City Film 50, that's the magazine New City. Every year they choose the 50 most influential or 50 people in Chicago that are influencing film in fantastic ways. And naturally, Comfort Film is going to show up on that because you guys are doing this great film series. I guess it might be a little bit of a standard question, but how did it feel to get on there again?
We don't expect to get any accolades, to be honest. Like, mm-hmm. It's always a surprise to us that we get, you know, some kind of accolade. The great thing about that list is that it's voted by your peers in the scene. So it's your peers are the ones that are paying attention to you.
Yeah,
and so that's a great thing when our peers are saying, you know, we think that Comfort Film is doing good stuff.
And also Ray Pride, who, you know, has the Herculean task of just, like, putting together all those, you know, that's 50, but he still has, like, over, I don't know, 200 people to, like, you know, choose from. Mm-hmm. Some of them friends that he has to go and, like, create a list that highlights people who are producers, you know, working with budgets for films and television, people who are doing things like archives, people who are doing things like screening films at something like the Gene Siskel or the Music Box, and then, you know, there's us who are, like, community-based. And, yeah, it's cool because we get nominated, and in this year, Raul was also asked to nominate someone else, so another film series that kind of does the same thing that we do, he was able to bring down that list. But, yeah, I mean, it's a great feeling because it shows that, you know, in the 5 years that we've been, people have recognized our work. Often, some of the people in that list are friends because we either go to their film series or we have been able to collaborate with them, so they have brought films with us. So, you know, that's something that's, for us, is like very satisfying to just like see this community like recognize each other, giving each other a pat on the shoulder.
And both of you have been very involved in the film community for a long time here in Chicago. I know, Raul, you've got a laundry list of different festivals and groups that you've worked with doing programming. Nando, same. You've been working in film here in Chicago for a while. What is it about the Chicago film community that is different from somewhere like L.A. or New York?
I think there's and I've heard this from other artists, like here in Chicago, like there's a lot of support between not only, you know, just like filmmakers, but not only among filmmakers, but like spaces that host films. And, you know, sometimes we get films that we can't host. So I email other spaces like, hey, I got this person was looking for a place to show. Maybe you guys could show it. And they do the same thing. They send us some stuff. And, you know, then over the years, there's been more and more spaces showing film. But the way we look at it is there's enough film for everybody in the city to show. The city's big enough, you know, and everybody has their own audiences. Like, I also program at the Nightingale Theater in Noble Square, and they have their own particular audience, and it doesn't mesh with our audience. It's just, so there's enough for everyone, and, you know, there's the Micro Cinema and Pilsen now Film Front. They do their own thing where they do more, like, discussion-based
Like a screening club.
Yeah, like a cinema club.
Okay.
So everybody kind of does different things. It's enough for everyone, all of us. I mean, and you guys know John Davies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's got his thing in the same neighborhood as we do. So he's got his own audience and he does his own thing. So, you know, we're all in some basic level, we're collaborating. And part of that is that me and Nando host a film programmer's potluck. Independent film progress potluck that we do every season, and we invite most of the film programmers, you know, to come and meet and chat, and we feel that it's important for all of us to kind of know each other, and that way we could share resources and, you know, give advice, because I think part of the film programming is that we should be mentors to help other people who want to go into programming.
It's not a zero-sum game here.
Yeah, and I mean, maybe some people don't share our view, but I think it's important to do that. And, you know, we have varying success with our potluck. You know, sometimes we have a lot of programmers come, sometimes, you know, one or two come, but we continue to do it because we feel that it's important. It's important that we're all in it together, and we're all doing the same thing at various levels, whether you're a programmer at the Music Box or at Hume. Like, this girl, Emily, does programming, field programming at Hume that just started this year, which is our space in Logan Square, and we invited her because we're like, hey, and she was like, why are you inviting me? I'm like, because you're doing film programming, so you should be part of this.
Come to the potluck.
So yeah, come to the potluck, and, you know, you get meat. And I feel like, especially these smaller series that programmers do, it's a way for them to know that, you know, that they're welcome and they're doing important stuff too, whatever it is, and, you know, they get asked for help from us and advice and whatever. So we'll continue to do those potlucks, at least in the near future.
Now, we've interviewed a lot of independent filmmakers and film programmers on this show before, and a common thread that Tom and I both have found between them is that this sort of all-for-one kind of mentality, which you were talking a little bit about, Raul. I did want to ask, do you think that something like comfort film in its current form could exist somewhere, could exist outside of Chicago, say in New York or Los Angeles?
Wow. I don't know. I mean, maybe,
there's like very specific things that make comfort film a thing in its own. Like, first of all, our location. You know, we are not the only series in Logan Square, but we are, I think, one of the longest ones. We're in a historic building. We are in a gallery. We are volunteer run. We try to keep our programming every week for, you know, like 10 months. So that's maybe like over 48 weeks, maybe. I don't know if anywhere else people would like have the passion to like do it for that long, you know, oftentimes more than once a week. I mean, like sometimes zero, like maybe three or four times on a given week during the summer. We have tried to reach out to a diverse community of filmmakers, because the city is not just creating sort of like fiction or documentary or like activism-based work. I mean, I can't think, because we also know people who live and work in LA. We know friends who are artists who work in New York. And so far, they haven't come across as saying something like, oh, this program that I was able to book here with you, I was able to like book elsewhere. So far, that hasn't happened. There's micro cinemas that have a more business-based focus, so they have a whole structure that, you know, supports them financially. We just kind of like go by the donations and by the will of ourselves, and also the other people that work with us, Matthew and Emily, yeah, and other people that work with us, such as, you know, Chelsea and Adrian. So I don't know. I don't know if that's a thing where like other people are actually, you know, taking time from their very already stressful week to go and program, because it's not just, you know, showing the movie. It's also kind of like the work that you have to do prior to that, and showing up an hour before to set up, and then, you know, maybe like an hour after breaking down. So that's like 4 hours.
Yeah, it's almost like a second job for us, because there's a lot of like following up with filmmakers and setting up the day, and that's why I like to. Excuse me. I like to start programming way ahead of time. That way we have stuff booked and we don't have to really worry about it too much. Mm-hmm. The first year that we programmed at Comfort Station, the series looked totally different. We were showing kind of like a lot of like more independent films with bigger budgets. And we're kind of flying under the radar as projection rights wise. And then the next year we totally changed our programming. So we started focusing on showing more local filmmakers, more stuff that was in like way independently made, DIY made, and a lot of other things. So our program has changed since that first year, and now I don't know where I was going with that.
Yeah. Well, it's just growing and changing.
Oh, yeah, it's growing and changing. I can't speak to other scenes in other cities because I've never been. Mm-hmm. Like, I never checked out the cinemas in New York, like our micro cinemas, or in L.A., I know L.A., several people have told me that L.A. doesn't have this community-based film
network. Seems competitive.
I mean, there's something to it where, like, the first year we were showing films that, you know, were films that have been released theatrically and or, you know, with a small limited run, but that we liked. Something like that perhaps does exist, where, like, an independent filmmaker or a small artist is invited to show a film that they like, you know, like a David Lynch film or, you know, perhaps like a John Cassavetes film. And they get to do that in a space, but they don't get to program their work and their friends' work. So perhaps there are micro cinemas or like cine clubs that show work that's been released before, but again, I can't speak for other, but I'm pretty sure that what we're doing in going and reaching like filmmakers who studied production and direction in Colombia, or people who studied kind of like more art-based video installation at ACIC, or people who never had like a training but had you know years of experience working behind music videos and web series, like we're able to connect with all those people, and that's why our program in a given month or 2 months you can see something that is like, oh, we're going to show experimental work from students from ACIC, and we're also going to show a web series that you know got a grant from Chicago filmmakers, which we have done with Amar, who also made it on the film 50. He brought and showed stuff from Open TV, which is queer based web content.
Yeah, we love Open TV. We actually had folks from Afternoon Snatch, one of the shows.
Oh, okay, and I know, cool. Yeah.
Yeah, and I know with Amar and Open TV, they had Brown Girls picked up,
yeah,
and Brown Girls, I believe, won a Webby as well best streaming.
Yeah, we had Amar. What he did was he brought stuff that Open TV wasn't producing, but they were kind of supporting.
Mm-hmm.
So we showed that with Amar, and we're hoping we could do more stuff with Open TV because I think that's a very important project that's really kind of taken off the past year. But, I mean, that's kind of stuff that we kind of do at Comfort Station. We're very broad-based. We talk to a lot of people doing different things everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, Not to say, but, you know, if you can show me another space that is showing a film from the 80s on VHS on the same month that they're going to show the ethnographic works of black and brown filmmakers, and at the same time they're going to host a film festival that it's all female filmmakers, I'd like to see that, because right now I don't think that there is one that is that eclectic.
Extremely unique. So what is next for Comfort Station and Comfort Film? Where do you guys see yourselves in about a year?
I know we just recently turned into a nonprofit. So Comfort Station itself is now its own nonprofit. And I know we were looking to get grants because we have a lot of body of work behind us, 5 years worth. Mm-hmm. So we're hoping that we get some grants for next year. And hopefully that would help in, you know, we have a kind of a small budget this year for getting projection rights, which we really didn't have to dip in that much. But I think for next year, I think we want to improve mostly, you know, we'll have some money, more money to get projection rights for stuff. And then hopefully we can get some better, you know, upgrade our projection equipment. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, bring in as much, you know, eclectic stuff as we can, you know, to show at Cover Station, which I'm now starting in the process of trying to set up for next year.
I mean, there's a few things that we try like a year, and then if they succeed, you know, either because the filmmaker brings a really good program or because the audience likes it, we do it. That's why the silent film with live music we've done, you know, 5 years now. Mm-hmm. Something that we did 2 years ago and that we did this year, which we want to do, is dedicate a whole month to projecting celluloid. So that's kind of like in the experimental side of it. Mm-hmm. We hosted a filmmaker named Irving Gamboa who had a whole night for just showing his work. And that's something that that came up from a different thing, but we focused specifically in showing 16 and Super 8 film. And I think that's another thing that we want to do next year. And, you know, perhaps given that we have the budget, because that's kind of like film, we have our own projector. But, you know, we also like to be able to, like, fly people from other places. Mm-hmm. And again, just like Raul was saying, be able to, like, you know, make their trip worthwhile.
Yeah.
So program with other people.
Yeah, because last year we had Ulises Guzman, who we flew in, who came from Mexico. And he's like a horror film director in Mexico, and we showed some of his stuff and one of his projects, and we had money enough to pay, you know, help him come over.
Right.
And we had to write a lot of a recommendation that he could show to the government there, saying, "Hey, I'm going to go for a cultural project in Chicago." So that's more stuff that we want to do, and you know, we focus more this year and more previous than in the past. We've done more Latin-based films,
right?
In Cover Station, and that was something that our general programmer or
artistic director
Jordan Martins, who's Brazilian, he's been in the past he's been saying you guys should show more like Latin-based films. So we've done that more this year than previous years, and we'll probably expand that next year too, hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, Raul and I being two of the few Latino filmmakers in the city, it's something that, you know, we want to do.
Film programmers in the
film
city.
Film programmers, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this year we teamed up with the Latino Film Festival for the first time ever, something that we've been trying to do over the years, and we finally broke through. And, you know, we teamed up with them to show up a screening before their festival. So hopefully we can do that more next year. So lots to come, hopefully, next year.
Fantastic stuff. Coming up this Wednesday, it's going to be part of your Halloween series, Halloween at Comfort Film, Project Nightmare from 1987. And that one is sponsored by Daily Grindhouse. Get on out there. It's at Comfort Station. It's that little house at
right off Milwaukee.
Yeah. Right off of Milwaukee. If you want to find anything about Comfort Station, the events that's going on, not just Comfort Film, but everything about Comfort Station, you can head on over to comfortstationlogansquare.org. That's where they have the list for everything coming up with Comfort Film. You guys are also on Facebook, Comfort Station Logan Square, and also Comfort Film. And check out that New City Film 50. They're on there. It's a great to see two hardworking people in the film community in Chicago getting recognized. So Raul Benitez and Nando Espinoza, thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate
it. Yeah, thank you for having us.
All right. Sweet. We're going to be back in just a little bit here on No Coast Cinema. We're going to be talking a little bit about Blade Runner 2049 and the Rotten Tomatoes effect. Stick around. right, everybody. Noco Cinema, Tom Hush, Connor Cornelius.
Am I hearing an echo in here?
Echo in here?
Echo in here?
Echo in here?
Equine hair? Equine hair?
Back on Noco Cinema, your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago and all around the world. Going to be moving into our after credits where we want to talk a little bit of business here, specifically the box office. Normally we would do this in our news segment, but we had bigger fish to fry, frankly.
Nice.
So the long-awaited sequel to Blade Runner, Blade Runner 2049, 35 years in the making, has finally dropped. And it's been a little bit rough. Open to a fairly poor $13 million on Friday, which sounds like a lot of money, but when that's going against a $155 million budget, that is not what they were looking for. This is coming to us from Forbes.com. Writer Scott Mendelson letting us know that, yeah, $13 million was the debut. He's saying at best, he thinks this movie will tie Alien Covenant's $36 million debut for the weekend. So it's still early days. The marketing for this movie has been pretty intense, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. Beautiful trailers showing off the visual scope of the film, which is, if you've read any of the reviews, has been one of the largest probably boons for the movie. Mm-hmm. And also one of the largest boons to Denis Villeneuve's sort of mythos or ethos that he's created with his film career.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because inside the film buff community, this has been like an event. This movie is getting rave reviews.
Yeah.
Rave reviews.
Near unanimous positive reception.
Absolutely. Mark Kermode of the BBC said this film made him weep. Now, maybe it's a little bit much, but hey, you know what? I'm not going to tell people how they reacted to a film. There have just been unanimous praise for Blade Runner 2049. However, it has not turned into any sort of like massive success at this point.
At this point.
It's early days. We are recording this on Saturday, October 7th. So the weekend's not over. Who knows how it's going to do tonight, this Saturday? Who knows how it's going to do Sunday? One Monday when this episode is released, it might be a completely different story. However, it is something to look at when it comes to the much debated Rotten Tomatoes effect. Now, Brett Ratner, the director of such rave films as Rush Hour, Rush Hour 2, Rush Hour 3...
and Rush Hour 4.
Is that happening?
It just got announced.
Exclusive. Anyway, Brett Ratner always kind of, he has this beef with Rotten Tomatoes, and he previously kind of blamed the dip in movie revenue on this Rotten Tomatoes effect. Is people go to Rotten Tomatoes, they want to see if a movie's good. And
you see that little green icon next to the movie, and they're like, oh, I'm not going to go spend $12 to $15 on that.
Yeah, which, frankly, I don't blame them.
No.
I will say this. I use Rotten Tomatoes to kind of get the sense of a feeling for a film, see what people are saying. I mainly go to it because it has the film reviews there. Like, you can go scroll down and see the critics and read specific critics, and it kind of aggregates them into that one place, which I find incredibly useful. Are you a Rotten Tomatoes?
Absolutely, yes. I do try to mix it up. You know, I like to use... I do like to use like IMDb and like Metacritic. I try to use those because I think that in certain cases they're a little bit harder on films, you know, across the board. But I do use Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah, Rotten Tomatoes is a good resource, and maybe people are putting a little bit too much stock into how much a tomato meter rating is going to tell them what if they're going to like a movie. It's a dipstick test. It's just giving you a sense of how much oil is in there. Do you need to change the oil?
And the oil is, in this metaphor, terms of quality.
You got to get that synthetic shit. Replicants.
Anyway.
Anyway, leaving this extended metaphor behind.
It was a good one. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, he does make some pretty interesting points in this article, and I'm glad that Mr. Mendelsohn does, because it's worth talking about the fact that the original Blade Runner, while now is a classic and considered a standard of the genre, 35 years ago, it did not do super... It wasn't, like, a big success. It earned $27 million on a $28 million budget, and that was in 1982. That's a domestic... He's considering that a flop.
Yes.
Although I think there are bigger flops than that, but... You know, there is this sense of, you know, are people going to come out and see a 2.5+ hour R-rated sci-fi drama that many people do not have any sort of context for? A lot of folks who I've spoken to are saying, like, oh, shit, I have to go watch the original Blade Runner because I've never seen it.
Right.
Despite being this kind of cultural thing, they've never seen it.
And a lot of the hype surrounding this is from people who have seen it, love the movie, because I actually watched it last night. It's beautiful, kind of even like almost like a little bit of a sleepy, surreal film. And if you're not familiar with the original or just haven't seen it in a long time, maybe you're not really getting plugged into this hype that has been, it's a little bit of a bubble effect, maybe.
Yeah. I like, yeah, a bubble effect of people who are really into the movie just like, just fawning over it. Yeah. I mean, it's Blade Runner, you know.
But then on the other end, you've just got a whole mass of people who are just like, I don't really give a shit.
Yeah. I think the way that he, the way that he frames it here is pretty interesting. He's saying that, like, if you're just a regular, you know, person, maybe you got kids or something, he's putting it as like, would you get a babysitter for this movie?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I like, he puts it as, if this were a 120-minute PG or PG-13 movie that could justify a family night or a Saturday matinee with the kids, that would be a different story. But as we saw with Scream 4 back in 2011, there is a difference between I'm interested and I will pay for a babysitter and related expenses to go see that R-rated sequel in theaters, which is why he doesn't feel optimistic about the legs of this film, how far it's going to go. It does make me sad, though, because maybe it points to this idea that people don't want to go see a movie that might challenge expectations. And it sounds I will admit that sounds a little elitist. We're talking about a relatively niche product,
right?
Here.
It's a heavy genre film. People are looking at it and they're just saying, you know, I'm going to go see whatever else is. I'm going to go see, you know, Gretchen Goes Well. I'll just go see like a lighthearted comedy or something, you know?
And I don't blame them because, you know, it takes effort to sit through a movie like this. Now, I will say at this point, Connor and I have not seen Blade Runner 2049. We are fans of the original property, but we have not seen it. But it seems to be it's a niche movie.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, Warner Brothers wanted to be a Mad Max, which is weird because Mad Max Fury Road was a crossover hit.
Right.
That really made a lot of money. It got so much attention.
But it was also promising to be an action film. Whereas
precisely,
if you've seen the original Blade Runner, it's a lot of psychological tension building up.
It's noir.
It's very noir. There's a lot of themes that you just sort of get to swim through, and it's a beautiful movie. And it is a great film-going experience, but it's not the 2-hour nonstop car chase that Mad Max was. Fury Road, I mean.
Right. Yeah. Because, yeah, you know, you make a really good point there, Connor. It's and there were people that actually really they really went against the hype for Mad Max. Now, I loved Mad Max Fury Road. I thought it was a huge revitalization of the action genre and the return of a fantastic director and taking it in a subversive direction. But there were some people who were just like, I just watched a fucking 2-hour car chase. And I totally agree with that. But
well, that's
at the
what
end
it is, yeah.
Yeah. I think that's the genius of the movie, but that's just like my opinion, man.
Yeah.
You know? yeah. It's I can see why they wouldn't like it, but at the end of the day, it was a crossover hit. But you can't adapt Blade Runner. Like, you can't expect Blade Runner in all its heavy sci-fi imagery and weightiness to be a crossover hit. I know you have Ryan Gosling. I know you have Jared Leto, Robin Wright, Dave Bautista. You've got big name. Harrison Ford is back.
But I think in the article that Scott Mendelson wrote, I do think that he even mentions, like, Ryan Gosling is not an opener.
I guess not.
Harrison Ford hasn't been an opener since What Lies Beneath.
Yeah, okay. 6 Days, 7 Nights is a masterpiece.
Yeah, yeah. You want to go?
You want to fucking go?
Yeah.
Motherfucker. Let's talk about Harrison Ford with his shirt off. No, but you're right. Well, not even with The Force Awakens? You know, he came back in, but maybe that was just the nostalgia well ran dry for him. It does seem like a weird property to come back. I feel like, you know, and the reviews are saying like this, you know, Denis Villeneuve does great things with the property and it makes me excited. But at the same time, like, could we have done without a Blade Runner sequel? Like, probably.
Probably.
I guess.
I'm glad that it's there. I mean, I feel like I'm going to enjoy it. I loved Blade Runner, the first one.
Yeah.
I've seen it a bunch of times.
But that shit's not for everybody. Like,
no.
There are some people, and I talk with a lot of my friends frequently about film, and I was just like, oh, are you guys hyped for Blade Runner 2049? Prior to the reviews coming out, they were just like, fuck no. Why would I want to watch this? The original is boring as hell.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, what do you mean it's boring? And again, film elitist side coming out here. I just really love the original Blade Runner, and
I watched it last night with my roommates, and we were all just sort of, even though we're not all, I'm maybe more of a film elitist to use that terminology than my roommates, but they all were saying this movie is beautiful, and it was shot in the early 80s, 1982.
Yeah,
I mean, it's impossible, I think, to not be able to acknowledge how much of a triumph that film is.
And maybe that's the problem, is that we are trying to exchange this kind of cultural currency for financial success, and that doesn't necessarily work.
Yeah, it doesn't add up.
You can't, yeah. As you said, how many people can you get to realistically sit down? Damn, you can barely get people to sit down and watch a 90-minute movie without pulling their phones out. You know, how do you expect people to sit through a 2.5 hour plus?
It's 2 hours and 45 minutes. It's 2 hours, almost 3 hours.
Almost 3 hours. People just don't do that anymore. You'd be hard pressed to get someone to sit down to watch a much more relevant piece of pop culture, like the Lord of the Rings extended editions. You might have a hard time with that now. And there are people who religiously watch the Lord of the Rings, and like, I know for me personally, I only watch the extended editions.
Yeah, same.
But I don't really blame.
Yeah,
I don't blame people for being like, that is too long for me to just be sitting there. Like, and it has to have a much bigger appeal. You really got to hook people if you're going to have them sit down for almost 3 hours and watch a movie.
Yeah.
So, and I want to get back to this idea of the Rotten Tomatoes effect, and I'm going to say to you, Brett Ratner.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. I love Rush Hour 1 and 2. 3 wasn't great, but Rush Hour 1 and 2 were pretty fun for me. dude, it doesn't add up. The Rotten Tomatoes, it's not a 1-to-1 ratio.
No.
I think that they are completely overplaying the effect of the Rotten Tomatoes tomato meter. If it's when it comes to bad movies, make better movies.
Right.
When it comes to great movies, It's not a 1-to-1 ratio.
No, people are still not going to go. Obviously, people are not going to go see a movie, even if it is at the 90%, you know, mm-hmm. whatever, which pretty much means it's a good movie.
Yeah. And at least among critic circles, there is something to be said that there is a bit of a hive mind when it comes to critics, though.
Sure.
No one there is definitely an incentive not to be caught as the odd one out hating a movie. You don't want to be that person. You know, I know sometimes there's pressure for me. I get pressure for hating on a movie. Like, I have a lot of friends that really enjoyed Interstellar. Friggin' hate Interstellar. That's
hate it?
I friggin' hate it. Leahy.
You don't like Forrest Gump either.
No, I hate Forrest Gump. I've said that live on air on WGN. I've been like, let's talk about how bad Forrest Gump is and how overrated it is. Because then you get pegged as a contrarian.
Sure. Or an elitist,
which sucks. Because honestly, if there's someone out there, and the sad part is that in the case of Blade Runner 2049, you'll be pegged as stupid, which that's totally not fair. Like, if you're not a fan of Blade Runner 2049, stake that claim. If you're not a fan of the original Blade Runner, stake that claim. And don't be afraid to say, I just didn't like this movie. You don't need to be collecting this cultural capital so that people think that you're some sort of like genius when it comes to movies. You don't have to love all the classics. Just to reiterate, the Rotten Tomatoes thing is not 1-to-1. Just because you got a poor tomato score doesn't mean you're not going to make a hell of a lot of money. And just because you got a high tomato score doesn't mean you're suddenly going to be like,
Rocketed to the number one box office.
Absolutely. Any closing thoughts, Connor?
See, that feels good.
That
feels good after sort of a heavy...
Some
heavy things.
Absolutely. All right, guys. Thank you so much for listening to the show. We are going to be back with you again next week. Connor, it's always a pleasure.
Thanks, babe.
Next time, maybe we should find a movie that we... Can we find a movie that both... That we disagree on? Let's do some
next time.
Next time on NoCo Cinema. Movies that they disagree on.
Am I hearing a new theme? I think so.
Head on over to WGN Radio. That's where you can find all of our episodes. It's under the WGN Plus tab. Just click on WGN Plus Entertainment and find NoCo Cinema. If you miss an episode, it's all there. And if you use Apple Podcasts, head on over to Apple Podcasts.
We're on iTunes.
Yeah, iTunes. Just subscribe. Give us a rating. It helps people find the show and helps us get more of our interviews out there. We want everybody to be hearing about what's happening here in Chicago because it's such a great film community. It's such a great city. Help us by giving us a subscription and also giving us a rating on Apple Podcasts. If you want to keep up with us, we're doing this whole 31 days of horror films for October. We've each got lists. They're going to be up on the Facebook. Check out what we're watching there. You can follow us at NoCo Cinema Podcast. That's on Facebook. So facebook.com/NoCo Cinema Podcast. We're on Twitter as at NoCo Cinema. And you can find me on Instagram at Mount Hushmore. Where can people follow you, Connor?
You can find me on Instagram as Surly Nurbler. And it's spelled just like it sound. Like it sounds.
My mother's maiden name.
And on Twitter as Chint Gargans.
Worth saying that I have to say this because Connor and I go back. We went to high school together. These are some deep references. These are some truly esoteric references.
These are just some characters that I've created over the years. And it's just...
Absolutely. All right. We'll see you guys next week. This has been NoCo Cinema. Bye-bye, Connor.
Bye, Tom.